Hello again. Welcome to our To the Point podcast. Today, we're talking about two of America's longest-running controversies, racism, a major news topic this week, and farm labor. Our main segment is an astonishing story of how tomato pickers liberated themselves.
They pointed out the tomatoes that Taco Bell were using could have been picked by the hands of a slave.
And that's right. Slave labor still exists in America's agriculture industry, but not among Florida's Immokalee tomato pickers. They persuaded Taco Bell, Whole Foods, and other major food buyers to help free them and to provide sustainable living conditions. One grower says he learned a lot from Dr. Martin Luther King. And speaking of Dr. King, our added attraction revisits his belief that racism is one of America's existential qualities, and yet most of us are in denial. Here's President Trump.
No, I'm not a racist. I am the least racist person you have ever interviewed. That I can tell you.
Ibram Kendi is a professor of history and international relations at American University and founding director of its Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center. He's also author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. Professor, welcome to our program.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on.
What do you say to the President of the United States, or about the President of the United States, who, when he says, "I am the least racist person you have ever interviewed"?
Well, my first question would be to ask him, what is a racist? And it seems to me he has no conception of what a racist is, his conception of a racist tries to define himself out of racism. Or he knows precisely that he is a racist, and he knows the only way that he can cause people to not label him one is, of course, to deny being one.
What do you mean by racist?
So I define a racist as a person who expresses a racist idea or a person who supports a racist policy. And a racist idea is any idea that suggests a racial group is superior or inferior to another racial group, and a racist policy is any policy that yields to an unequal outcome. And Trump has both expressed racist ideas before being president, and even still as president, and he's supported a series of racist policies.
How do you define those policies as racist? Why do you call them that?
Well, again, I define a policy as racist as a policy that yields an unequal outcome. In other words, a voter ID law leads to a greater suppression of black voters than any other racial group, or a poll tax leads to a greater the suppression of black voters than any other group, or a white-only sign on a restaurant yields only white people eating in that restaurant and black people being excluded. And so to me, his voter ID laws that his administration has supported, his immigration rhetoric as well as laws are reflective of racist policies. His decision to say that there is not a war on black lives and instead there's a war on cops, even though last year 37% of the unarmed victims of police violence were black, even though black people represent 13% of the population, is reflective of racism.
There are, of course, expressed motives of a different kind for voter ID, the poll tax, the defense of police, and so on. But what you're saying is not so much what you say in advance, it's the consequences that you're concerned about.
Precisely. So I know that when you think of a racist policy in a popular sense, we typically think about it as it relates to intention. And so in other words, somebody intended to discriminate or exclude a particular group of people. And over the last 50 years in particular, this concept of intention has become the way in which people understand racist policy. But what I'm also saying is that those who are seeking to discriminate against people know that. And in knowing that, they seek to hide their intention. And so instead of saying, I'm seeking to disenfranchise black voters or students or elderly voters through a voter ID law, instead they create a different justification of voter fraud that we know, of course, is a negligent thing in order to justify their policy, because they can't say that they're seeking to discriminate against a particular group of a racial group of people.
Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois was in the room at the White House when President Trump allegedly called African countries and, by extension, the country of Haiti, shithole countries. Here's what Senator Durbin had to say.
This was a horrible moment in the history of our country and in the history of the Oval Office in the White House.
Professor, what do you think of that comment?
Well, I agree that it was a horrible moment in the nation's history and the history of the Oval Office. But what I don't agree with Mr. Durbin is that it's somehow exceptional. And it's exceptional for the U.S. presidency or even the Oval Office. A U.S. presidency that has had eight presidents who, while they were in the Oval Office, held slaves. A U.S. presidency that had an Abraham Lincoln who urged in the Oval Office black people to voluntarily leave the country. An Oval Office that had people like Woodrow Wilson who segregated the federal government and praised the birth of the nation, or even an Oval Office that held Lyndon B. Johnson, who was known to use the N-word as often as Ku Klux Klansmen. And so I think it's important to say it was a horrible event, but to make it in any way exceptional, I think, is denying the pervasive and the longstanding existence of racism within the U.S. presidency.
You mentioned Abraham Lincoln as urging blacks to leave the country. I don't think a lot of people know about that. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, so Lincoln was smitten with probably one of the most popular race-related reform movements before the Civil War, and that was the movement of colonization. And so colonizationists believed that the way to solve the race problem was to free black people and then urge black people to basically vacate the United States. And so they were anti-slavery, but they certainly were not against black people becoming free, being given civil and voting rights, and us living out in equal existence. They felt that by black people persisting in the country, it would only create basically racial problems. They also believed that black people could not compete with white people because they were inferior. And so Lincoln, like his mentor Henry Clay, who was a longtime president of the American Colonization Society, which was the leading sort of organization for this movement, was a major advocate of colonization. And so while Lincoln was president, he was able to advocate for it, figure out ways. He actually had federal agents going into different countries to figure out where black people could be relocated to. And it wasn't until it became strategically impossible and black people were needed as soldiers to win the war that he gave up on colonization.
You mentioned Lyndon Johnson and the kind of language that he used, no doubt from the time that he grew up in Texas. And yet he was responsible for causing to be enacted and then finally signing the Civil Rights Act of 1965. Did the consequences of his action, in your mind, forgive him from the kind of racism that he expressed?
Well, I guess the way that I try to think about people's actions and even people's words is to not think about them in their totality. In other words, What people try to do in analyzing a Lyndon B. Johnson or even Abraham Lincoln is say, oh, Johnson pushed through the Civil Rights Act of 64 and Lincoln was involved in emancipation, so clearly they're not racist. As opposed to us specifying the things that they said and did over the course of their career. In other words, this thing that they said was racist, that thing that they said was anti-racist. And so that's what I think we should do, because they were involved in a series of different things over the course of their lives, and they said a series of different things. And human beings are very complex people, and so in my book, Stamped from the Beginning, I actually chronicle how so many Americans, like Lincoln and Johnson, held both racist and anti-racist ideas, supported both racist and anti-racist policies. And so that's how I think we should be thinking about those figures.
Again, the book, should our listeners want to look it up, is Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. And we're talking with Ibram Kendi, professor of international relations and history at American University. So what should people think when their friends, their neighbors, people that they talk to, deny racism? Is that something that you can just never believe?
Well, I think first and foremost, and I think that we should recognize, as I wrote in the Times piece, that denial is the heartbeat of racism. And so fundamentally, every generation of racists in American history have denied that they were racist. So slaveholders did not believe what they were saying and doing was racist. They stated that, you know, we have a constitutional right to hold property, or black people are the cursed descendants of Ham. Segregationists thought that they constitutionally had states' rights to determine the way in which their states were organized racially, and that separate was indeed equal. And, of course, mass incarcerators believe that black people are more criminal-like than white people, and that's why black people are disproportionately killed by police, and that's why black people are disproportionately imprisoned. And so what I'm saying is that this, the denial that the ideas and the policies are racist is baked into racism itself. It is the heartbeat. And so I think we should not be surprised when we hear that heartbeat of denial.
So this is a racist country.
Oh, without question. And I think the way we can see that it's a racist country is by seeing that racial inequities and inequality is everywhere. I mean, in very few sectors of society is there racial, any sort of racial parity. And so for me, when I'm looking for racism, I'm not looking for intention, because people can easily hide intent. What I'm looking for are there racial inequities? Is it the case that 40% of the incarcerated people in this country are black, even though black people represent 13% of the population? Is it the case that white people have far and away more wealth than black people? Is it the case that in almost every health area there are disparities between the races? Is it the case that over the last 50 years, the black unemployment rate has been twice as high as the white unemployment rate? You know, we have all of this data that shows there are racial inequities, and that, to me, is what demonstrates that this country is racist, because either those disparities that are all around us are the result of black inferiority, or they're the result of racist policies. And because I do not believe, based on hundreds of years of people making the case for black inferiority, and they have yet to actually prove it, that the racial groups are unequal. And so that means the only other explanation for all of these inequalities is that our country is racist.
Ibram Kendi, once again, op-ed author of a Ibram Kendi, once again, the author, as he just mentioned, of an op-ed piece in the New York Times called The Heartbeat of Racism is Denial. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
On another To the Point podcast this week, I'll interview David Garrow about his Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Dr. King, Bearing the Cross. Now, today's main story. The liberation of farm workers in the tomato fields of Florida. In 1960, CBS News aired one of its most famous documentaries, Harvest of Shame, narrated by Edward R. Murrow.
This is an American story that begins in Florida and ends in New Jersey and New York State with the harvest. It is a 1960 Grapes of Wrath that begins at the Mexican border in California and ends in Oregon and Washington. It is the story of men and women and children who work 136 days of the year and average $900 a year. They travel in buses. They ride trucks. They follow the sun.
Well, I don't know. It don't look like we'll ever get ahead. I guess we'll just have to keep going till we can find something better.
A minister named Cassidy, who works with them, says,
they are just as bad as the slaves. Only on name they are not a slave, but in the way they are treated, they are worse than a slave. And somebody has to make thousands of dollars out of his sweat.
They are the migrants, workers in the sweatshops of the soil, the harvest of shame.
The conditions we just heard described in 1960 still exist in American agriculture today, including actual slavery, but not in the tomato fields of Florida. That's because of a 30-year campaign by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Their effort and their achievement is the subject of a recent book called I Am Not a Tractor, How the Florida Farm Workers Took on the Fast Food Giants and Won. The author is Susan Marquis. She is Dean of the Pardee Rand Graduate School and Vice President of Rand. And Susan Marquis, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I Am Not a Tractor. How'd you come up with that?
Well, it goes back to a situation as much like what you heard about in Harvest of Shame. By the late 1990s, you still had workers that were showing up at dawn, before dawn, to get on the buses, to go and work in the fields. They had abysmal pay. They were subject to rampant wage theft, gun violence, sexual assault, all the way to, as you say, modern-day slavery. And so the Coalition of Immokalee Workers had stood up in the early 1990s, and by the late 1990s, they had run a series of actions, so strikes and various protests. In 1998, the end of 1998, they had a hunger strike. They were refused food for more than a month. They suffered a great illness as a result. Their idea was that they were suffering in this strike as their fellow workers did in the fields. This was started to get some national attention. And when the press talked to the growers, saying, why won't you just meet with this coalition? Why won't you just meet with the workers? And the farmer's response was, because the tractors don't tell me how to run my farm. And so, therefore, the coalition picked up the slogan that I am not a tractor.
Tell us about the model of the Statue of Liberty, the papier-mâché model. How was it used? Where is it now?
So they had one of their earliest marches, really quite a long march. It replicated some of what the marches that Cesar Chavez had led in California many years before. This was a march starting across Florida. They carried this papier-mâché, this 8-foot-tall papier-mâché Statue of Liberty, holding a tomato bucket, and pointing out that they were not tractors, that they were subject to, they had the right human rights like everyone else, that they had dignity of their work, and they were asking to be paid fairly for that work and be operate in safe conditions. But it was a pretty bold move, but characteristic of the coalition to have this bold visual as well as this compelling message.
So that all sounds familiar enough. In fact, in 1965, I was there. I covered Cesar Chavez and the farm workers when they arrived in Sacramento from Delano, which is a town south of Sacramento, some hundreds of miles in the San Joaquin Valley. And it still exists today. Tell us, though, what the Immokalee workers have done it makes their situation so utterly different from those of others.
So the Immokalee workers started in the same place as other farm labor organizations, highlighting, bringing visibility to their conditions through strikes, through protests, and hunger strikes and the like. But they stood back in 2000 and recognized that what they were doing, although it had given workers a voice, it actually hadn't accomplished the transformation in the fields that they believed was necessary and is what they were fighting for. So they stepped back in around 2000, spent a couple of years as workers examining their situation and starting to look at the system that they're a part of. So they call it looking outside of the farm gate. Looking outside the farm gate, they began to understand the food system from end to end, from the workers to the crew leaders to the growers to the buyers and even the customers themselves. And they realized that the power, the strength, in this system was really with the buyers, the fast food companies, the grocery stores, and the like. And they turned their attention to those to those buyers and said, we want you to help bring dignity and fair working conditions to the supply chain as a whole. At the same time that they are putting the pressure on the buyers, They developed a program that eventually became the Fair Food Program. It's a comprehensive program unlike any we've seen in any other labor organization or labor movement. It involves monitoring, audits, worker education, and real-world market sanctions for those who don't comply. And we can work into more detail on that as we move through this conversation.
Of course. Now, at first, though, tell us who the buyers are. There are some names, I think, that a lot of people will be familiar with.
Well, so they started, obviously, the fast food giants. So starting with Taco Bell, Burger King, McDonald's, and the like. Their very first, where they went first, was in protest against Taco Bell. And they pointed out that the tomatoes that Taco Bell were using in their food could have been picked by the hands of a slave. They also highlighted the sub-poverty wages, and they asked Taco Bell to pay a penny per pound more. Is penny per pound more for the tomatoes that they bought? If every buyer took that additional premium on, it would essentially double farm worker wages.
So that was the effort that was made. But let's back up a little bit and talk more about the conditions of the farm workers in the fields. And when you mentioned the bucket hanging in on the hand of the Statue of Liberty and that papier-mâché statue that is now in the Smithsonian Institution, there are buckets and then there are buckets.
There are. It's interesting. One of the greatest flashpoints for violence in the fields is this bucket of tomatoes. Farm workers at the time, the coalition was organizing, and as they were in the midst of the campaign for fair food, would have to pick about 2.5 tons of tomatoes each day in order to make a minimum wage. Now, that's daunting in and of itself, but then add to it that you couldn't start picking until the dew dried. Sometimes it would rain. Sometimes the tomatoes weren't ripe. It depended where you were in the harvest, whether or not you could actually pick the number of buckets to make minimum wage. The buckets themselves, as you say, a bucket is a bucket. It turns out that's not quite true. Workers are paid a piece rate, so about 40, 45 cents a bucket at the time. That was if it was filled. A bucket holds about 32 pounds of tomatoes. When they would bring their buckets of tomatoes to what are called the dumpers, the guys standing in the trucks who dumped the tomatoes into the trucks, the dumpers who worked for the crew leaders would demand that these buckets were cupped. So that means it's basically a crown on top. When you did that, it added about 10% to the bucket, so 34, 35 pounds of tomatoes. That doesn't seem much, but if you're picking 2.5 tons of tomatoes, you're losing 10% of what you're picking. Now, you're not being paid for 10% of what you're picking if you're a worker, and the crew leaders are getting a premium. They're getting a free 10%, so a free bucket for every 10 picked. When the workers would bring their buckets up, if it didn't have the crown, they were yelled at. The buckets may be thrown back in their faces. If they pushed back and fought that, they could be beaten up. It was the single biggest flashpoint for violence in the fields. It's something I bring this up only because it's something most of us would never think about.
Well, and something else most of us would never think about is the extraordinary skill that it requires to do all this. And you can see it in Harvest of Shame. You pick the tomato, then you have to toss it up to the guy on the truck, and he's going to toss it back, if he doesn't like the way it looks. What about the skill required to actually determine which tomato to pick and which to leave on the vine?
So, in general, if there's any color on the tomato, you don't pick it because we're talking about green, mostly green slicing tomatoes. John S. Forms, who's another guest here, knows more than I do on this. But the idea is that they need to be green because otherwise they'll get damaged in transport. And then they are ripened in the process of transport and later on in the process. So you're picking green tomatoes. You're scooping them with both hands into the buckets. There's a very distinctive sound that this makes. And then you're running down the fields to the end of the row, to the truck, throwing this 32 or 35-pound bucket of tomatoes up to the dumper and then running back down. And you may be doing this for 150 buckets in a day.
And that, once again, requires not just skill but extraordinary strength and dexterity. How young are some of the workers in the fields? In Harvest of Shame, we see kids that are 8, 10 years old. who are out there sometimes in families of 9 or 10. And some of them get left behind. Others have to work in the fields.
So you generally don't see child labor in the fields anymore. That was actually outlawed in the 60s, I think in part in reaction to Harvest of Shame. But you do see very young workers. So they may be 16, 17 years old. It's easier to do the younger you are. You do also see older workers. So there are workers in their 40s and 50s.
Let me introduce Mili Trevino Salceda. She is now president of the Alianza Nacional de Campesinos, and vice president, I should have said, and the co-founder of the Women's Farm Workers Movement. Great to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you just fine. And tell us about your life. You began in the fields at the age of 8. You now hold a master's degree in addition to position that I just described. But you didn't start doing that until you were 29 or 30. How long did you work in the fields? What was it like?
I did start working in the fields when I was 8 years old, along with my two other older siblings. And it was in the state of Idaho, and then in California as a teenager. And I can only tell you that during the times that my family migrated from one area to another in California, it was very, very hard. In the fields as a child, we got to see some other children, but not as many as we thought, you know, all along, going to work before school and then after school and then every weekend. It was picking irrigation pipes, disconnecting it from one line and then walking to where the other line was supposed to be hooked so that the irrigation could be done in the morning and then in the afternoon. So it was pretty heavy. And for an 8-year-old up to 11, we did that on a daily basis, and it was pretty hard. Some of us got sick, and I still have my brothers that have hernias in their stomachs because of the heavy, it was just heavy work.
Many times mothers have to take their babies out into the fields or wait behind in labor camps while their families do the work. We heard in that excerpt from Harvest of Shame a woman saying that she probably didn't have a chance ever to realize her ambition, which was to get out of there and live like other Americans or many other Americans do, most other Americans perhaps. How widespread is that sentiment that we'll never be able to get beyond this?
For us, this is what we're trying to push for. We started organizing with Farmer Girl Women in the late 80s here in California because a lot of us had gone through so much exploitation in the workplace, so many issues that were happening. I myself, when I was pregnant, I was laid off work, quote unquote, just because the owner saw me being pregnant and said, no, she cannot be here. And I didn't know my rights during that time. And for the same reason, we felt as we started learning and understanding that we here in the United States, there are some rights, especially in California because of the movement of the farmworkers, the union. We started learning that we do have rights in California. So in a way, as we started learning that there are options, that there are regulations, we started thinking that, for example, in our communities, men are the head of the household and women are the center of the family. And so if women are very well prepared, they can be able to share their knowledge with the whole family to organize the family, and the family can move beyond. And we're finding that it took us a long haul to be able to do that because it wasn't easy. We were actually called people that were trying to divide the family and that we needed to stay home and take care of our children when with time and being persistent and showing that our interest is to make sure that Farm workers have better health. Farm workers have better have more knowledge about their rights, and they here in California, you can organize. That's one of the benefits that we were able to get because of the UFW movement. And organizing with farm worker women, we learned that we needed to talk and create some change because there were issues along with the discrimination against women in the workplace and the harassment against women in the workplace were topics that no one knew how to deal with. And we needed to start talking about that issue. And of course, we admire the work that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers have done because they have created a movement to call attention to the plight of farm workers. And we're doing the same thing in California, and this is why we created the National Alliance of Farm Worker Women, thinking and believing that organizations like the Farm Worker Association of Florida, Campesinos Sin Fronteras, Líderes Campesinas here in California, Pineros, from workers in Oregon, women from the state of Washington, and from New Jersey and New York, all of us together, if we join forces, we could start creating changes. Because in California, we have supported for new legislation that protects farm workers. But at the same time, there's a lot of lack of interest of how in terms of providing the information to farm workers. There is some interest from health clinics to provide services, but there's the attention about what is going on with women in the workplace is something that we felt it was very, very important that we be the ones to do the change in our communities. And we've been successful because now women not only are talking in their homes with their families, with each other, and we're sharing the information. And let me just tell you, women, especially farm worker women, we organize a little bit different than anything else. We believe that organizing not only in the home is important, but organizing with each other and then creating this trust so that then we can go and talk to the public service, either state agencies or nonprofits or federal agencies, so that they can learn how to work within the cultural context of our community is very, very important.
I'm Orin Alney, and this is the podcast of To the Point. I want to get back to the Immokalee workers first before we go any further. Susan Marquis, you mentioned the growers that buyers have to deal with. We heard in Harvest of Shame a grower quoted, and when he was asked, why don't you meet with the workers, he said, well, the tractors don't tell me how to do my job. What about the growers, and how were the Immokalee workers able to get the growers to be such an important part of what they did?
So as I mentioned, the first focus of the Campaign for Fair Food was on the buyers themselves because the workers had not made any progress in getting the growers to even allow them to come to the table, much less to actually change the fields. By putting pressure on the buyers, they were able to get a whole series of these fast food giants to sign onto fair food agreements. So we had Taco Bell, McDonald's, Burger King, and the like. But by the end of that decade, the first decade, the 2000s, the growers had still not signed on. And they were really unified as a group. It was a very solid wall. They refused overall to meet with the workers or to sign on to the Fair Food Program. In 2010, a courageous grower, John S. Forms, who's now co-CEO of Pacific Tomato Growers, asked his board, "Have you even talked to these guys? Have you even started talking to the coalition directly? I don't care what the other growers think. I want to talk to them directly." And he did. And he reached out along with a couple of other members of the leadership team there. They met with the coalition, and in the fall of 2010, John broke with all the other growers and courageously signed on to the Fair Food Agreement. And his remarks at the time were remarkable, quoting Rabbi Heschel and talking about the responsibilities and if we should have done this earlier. We could have done this earlier, but we will do this now.
Okay, hang on a minute, because you've just introduced our next guest, and let me let him speak for himself. John Esformus, good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And Susan can speak for me anytime.
Why did you break with the others? Why did you do that?
We had been seeing our name repeatedly in the paper, in the newspapers, particularly the New York Times, along with other names from Florida associated with this whole scandalous thing going on in Florida around the slavery cases that had come up in the mid-2000s. While we had responded internally to the holes in our own business, and to the best of our ability at the time, cleaned up our business, you know, the story was still out there, and for good reason, because it was still going on in Florida. Susan mentioned the meeting, the board meeting, where some of our board members, family members, were a family-owned business, you know, were upset about our name being in the paper, and I asked them if anybody had met with them. And the answer was, you know, pretty clear that we've always relied on the grower organizations to represent us in these types of actions. And I asked point blank, well, how's that working out for everybody? Not very well. And quite frankly, I wasn't interested in the lowest common denominator. Typically, in large organizations where a lot of people are represented, the lowest common denominator has as loud a voice, if not louder, than anybody else. And we weren't, we ceased to be interested in hearing those voices. Personally, I had gone through my own period of, in my life, where I had done a lot of self-reflection. I'm a recovering drug addict and alcoholic with a little over 15 years of sobriety. And during my early recovery, I actually got sober in Los Angeles at a place called Beit Teshuva. And I had the opportunity to study Rabbi Heschel. Rabbi Heschel marched with Martin Luther King. They were great friends. And one of the teachings was that in a free society, some are guilty and all are responsible. And that line right there really informed all of our actions from the moment we reached out to the CIW. And that was that while we felt like we were no longer part of the guilty, we were still responsible for the health of the whole. That was basically it. It was as simple as that.
As far as getting the growers on board, was it a question of image and the way that they were being portrayed by the New York Times, as you indicated, and of course on Harvest of Shame all those many years ago, or was it genuine concern for the condition of other human beings?
Well, for us, it was pretty straightforward. It was, let's meet with these people. First and foremost, it started there when I met with Lucas Benitez and Greg Asbed. I walked in the room. I said, look, I'm here to have a cup of coffee with you. If I like you and I trust you, we'll have a further conversation. But it starts there. So for me, I understood what they were representing. I understood who they were representing. And if we were going to have a conversation about how we were going to do business together, I felt very strongly I needed to like them and I needed to trust them, because we're talking about a lifelong commitment here.
Okay, that's true of you. But again, generally speaking, as the pressure was applied, was it real concern from a humanitarian standpoint, or was it more an issue of we don't want to be portrayed as slavers in the national media?
Are you talking about my competitors, or are you talking about us?
I'm talking about the competitors. I'm talking about the growers as a group, the ones who are represented by the grower organizations.
I think you've got the whole gamut represented there. I think you've got everybody from growers who woke up when we signed the agreement and said, wait a second, if these guys are doing it, they're pretty smart guys. We've known them for many years. If they're doing it, there's a reason. To people who agreed to sign on because they were afraid of losing business.
So tell us how the one penny per pound situation works that we heard described earlier by Susan Marquis. The buyers, Taco Bell, McDonald's, Whole Foods, many others now, are paying a penny more per pound. How important is that in the process?
I think that's an important piece. The way that works is that if I invoice a Whole Foods or a Subway or a Burger King, I receive on that check from that customer an additional penny per pound for the pounds that they purchase. And then we do that as a straight pass-through directly to the entire workforce. So all the pennies are gathered and then spread out over the payroll as a line item on their checks. It's a direct pass-through that is audited by the coalition.
I was going to say, how is this enforced? How does the auditing process work? And do the farm workers themselves do that?
We, the coalition and the Fair Food Standards Council, have set up a system with the growers and the customers where there's a tight, closed audit trail, beginning with weekly payroll reporting.
And it works.
Yeah, yeah, it does work.
We heard earlier from Mili Trevino Sauceda saying that efforts are being made in California to do the same thing. You're a grower in California as well as in Florida. We haven't heard about this, though, very much in California, certainly not anything like what has happened in Florida. Why not?
Well, in California, it's a different situation. I'm proud to say that I am one of the few growers in California that has a vibrant relationship with the United Farm Workers Union. We are proud of our partnership with them, and I call it a partnership very deliberately. When, you know, my family has been farming in California since the late 40s, and quite frankly, during the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, until the early 90s, we had a very tough relationship with the United Farm Workers Union. We were on opposite sides, and those were very, very difficult times. You know, on the heels of having signed the agreement with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in 2010, that spring, I sat down with the United Farm Workers Union. We had our lawyer, they had their lawyer. I looked at their negotiators and I said, look, I don't even like the guy sitting next to me and he costs me a lot of money. I'd like to ask him to leave. You throw your lawyer out, I'll throw my lawyer out, and let's do this thing like human beings.
So,
they weren't quite sure what to make of that, but that was the genesis of our relationship. So we have a union agreement and we operate within the confines of a union employer relationship, which is a very, very different dynamic and a very different setup than what we have here in Florida with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. However, I will say that the UFW has gone to great lengths to work differently than the work with our company very differently than the confrontational type of relationship that often takes place when you have a union and a company working.
What about the brand name food suppliers? Taco Bell, McDonald's, Whole Foods really runs the gamut from that high-end grocery store to the fast food operations that Susan Marquis refers to in the title of her book. Do they exert the same kind of pressure in California? It's my understanding that if you don't pass muster with the union in Florida, they won't buy your tomatoes.
Right. Let's be real careful because the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is not a union.
Okay.
You know, it's really important to understand exactly what they are. It's a worker advocacy group.
Okay.
That's in partnership with industry And the third leg of that stool is the Fair Food Standards Council, which does the auditing and the enforcement side. I need to correct that piece.
No, I'm glad you did.
It's very, very, very important in terms of understanding the dynamic. The unique difference, and I think where the union movement is attempting to, and in some cases being successful in catching up, is that what the CIW did in the early 2000s was look at the entire food chain and understand the interconnectedness and interdependence that every piece of the chain has upon each other, from the producer of the seed to the consumer of the tomato. We are all dependent on each other to make this system work that produces all this food that seems so readily available in grocery stores and, you know, the 2-for-5 deal at Burger King or whatever it is. You know, food is so cheap in the United States. It's in the amount of money that is spent as a percentage of our income on food in the United States is so low relative to other countries. It's really, we have a tremendous abundance, quite frankly, going on in the United States, and that is this very, very efficient system that has developed over generations that is completely dependent upon everybody doing their part. And that's what the coalition recognized, and they blasted through those walls by going ahead and bringing the brands to the farm.
John Nisformis, again, CEO, SunRipe Certified Brands, Pacific Tomato Growers, the first of the growers in Florida to get on board with the system that we are now hearing about, which I think most importantly has led to the fact that that workers in Florida now earn a living wage. I want to go back to Susan Marquis, whose book is I Am Not a Tractor, How Florida Farm Workers Took on the Fast Food Giants and Won. Would this apply to other industries?
Absolutely. I think something to keep track of here is that this has been real, sustainable, measurable change. It's not just in Florida. In the tomato industry itself, it's moved all the way up the northeast coast, all the way up to New Jersey. And you've seen an elimination of those conditions that are rampant in American agriculture, elimination of wage theft, elimination of violence, of gun violence, of sexual assault, and modern-day slavery. So you can actually see the effect of this program in a way that you can't from many other agricultural programs. The other agricultural programs are really important because they're raising visibility, they're giving people voice. But this is the most comprehensive system with real-world market sanctions. Applicable to other industries, absolutely, not only through, obviously, other types of produce, other types of agriculture. We have seen it extend already to Vermont, to a group called Migrant Justice, has been advised by the coalition and has established an equivalent program in the dairy industry in Vermont, led by Ben, or eventually signed onto by Ben and Jerry's. You could also see this applying to factory labor. You could see it apply to other low-wage labor, even the gig economy. Any place where you have particularly a global market with global brands, you have that pressure point. You have the power of the brand, but also the vulnerability of the brand to this kind of identification with these kind of abuses. And so even if you have abuses occurring in another country, if the brand is selling or represented in the West in particular, the U.S., you can go after that brand, point out the problems in their supply chain, and frankly offer them a benefit. All the brands who have signed on now have guarantees of a clean supply chain in a way that you have not found with any of the other social responsibility programs.
Susan Marquis, why is it that the farm laborers in the United States are not subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act that was part of the New Deal?
Well, so you had two major pieces of legislation, as you say, the National Labor Relations Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1935, and I guess it's 1938. those provided sort of the basic protections we expect today. So no child labor, minimum wage, overtime, and the right to unionize, etc. In the 1930s, there were two groups that were excluded, deliberately excluded from this legislation: domestic workers and farm laborers. And the reason for that is that those who are sponsoring the bill needed Southern votes in Congress in order to get the legislation passed, and those were the two industries that were predominantly African American. Throughout our history, there has been some changes to these laws. There were some implementation of a minimum wage, I believe, in the 1960s. Until the 1970s, the minimum wage for agriculture was actually lower than in any other industries. But they still don't, farm workers still don't have most of the protections or most of the benefits that you would expect to see in a healthy and safe work environment. This includes protection from chemical poisoning or access to health care, et cetera. It has been, it's a problem that's existed in our country almost since our founding. It goes back to slavery. It goes back to our uneven relationship with immigrations and immigrants, where we bring them in because we need the labor, and then there's a backlash against immigrants and that in foreign labor. And we've seen throughout our history in the West in particular. So the combination of slavery, our relationship with immigration, has led to a farm laborer being left behind.
Mili Trevino Sauceda, you're a labor organizer. You started out at the age of 8 working in the fields, first in the northern part of the country, then in other parts of the country. Just describe, if you will, the working day of a tomato picker.
I would best describe a working day of a citrus worker or a grape worker that works in the grapes.
Okay, those are industries that aren't covered by the Immokalee Agreement. Go ahead, tell us.
The worker, before getting to their actual work, is that they have to prepare, and if they have children, they have to take their children to the child care. From there, sometimes they have they have to get transportation because most of them do not have vehicles to get to the workplace, so they're transported. And there's been many, many accidents because of that. And we are working on that, and we've done some changes towards that. And then as the worker arrives at the workplace, it's usually around 5 in the morning, so that they could start around 5:30, and sometimes they even start earlier if it's kind of clear. What they do is they gather to hear what are going to be some of the instructions from the crew leader, and they start doing the work. They're supposed to have every 2 hours a 10-minute break, and then they're supposed to have their at least half an hour lunch break that's not paid. And from there on, it all depends on the amount of hours that they're supposed to be, that they're given to work. At every 2 hours, they're supposed to have a 10-minute break. A lot of times we have found here in California that workers were not getting the 10-minute break, either in the morning or in the afternoon, and at times they were given just 10 minutes for them to have lunch because the company or the owner wanted to make sure that their product was, or there was enough or more product being harvested. And so that would create issues.
In Harvest of Shame, there are very dramatic stories with pictures of workers who have no place to stay. They have to sleep under the trees at night, and that's even true with their families as well. Is that still the case?
We still, even in California, we have those situations where workers are living right next to the fields, under trees, or even in parks. There's a lot of, here in Southern California especially, we have workers commuting all the way from the border towns or the other side of the border, crossing the border at 2, 3 in the morning to try to get to their job, and trying to make sure they have a job, because it all depends on the trucker. As they call them, the troquero, as in Florida, it's the same situation. Workers on a daily basis, they're trying to find out if they're going to get there's places in Southern California where workers need to get on buses. If the trucker allows them to get on the bus, even though they're not the ones that hire or fire, they're the ones that, if they allow the worker to get on the bus, then they're going to get a job. And on a daily basis, it's unpredictable if they're going to get a job the following day. And when they're in the field, we still, in California, we still have had issues of negligence by certain companies, growers, that send their applicators to go and apply chemicals, and some of the we've had incidents. Even this last year, we had incidents of workers being sprayed because, quote unquote, there was a mistake, and the applicator doing it by plane sprayed in the wrong field. But what happens? The workers were sprayed, or the drift right next to people's homes or the schools. We have had all these issues still happening.
So, John, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but John, as forms, these are the circumstances that you found intolerable.
Yeah, that and many others. I mean, listen, my experience is, quite frankly, and this came out of a meeting at UCLA Law School, that the legislation is all there. The laws are on the books. What's been lacking is enforcement. There aren't enough boots on the ground, whether it's California or Florida, by the authorities to be able to investigate and be sure to enforce the laws as they're written.
But Susan Marquis, back to you. In Florida, there is enforcement because of the deal that was worked out by the workers. Isn't that right?
And that's exactly where I was going to go. Sorry that with the relationship with the CIW, what we've done is we've added a third leg to the stool, and that is the enforcement side, along with every worker having gone through the training, being in partnership, to go ahead and make sure that any of these things that do take place are immediately reported and addressed.
And Susan Marquis, final word.
Can I beg to differ in terms of the laws that exist do not exist in all states, and the laws that exist in certain states, and certain organizations or certain programs are working, but the majority of the states for agricultural workers are not there. And this is why we need to continue working and making sure that there will be regulations. And yes, the monitoring, the enforcement is not there, but that is the work of Congress to try to put more funding so that there'd be more people doing their investigation, doing their work.
But Susan Marquis, you have said that you think because the situation worked out by the Immokalee Agreement, it was done without government, without regulation.
That's right. And I think where I've evolved in my own thinking, it was one of the things that motivated me to write about the coalition, is we need to recognize there are things the government does well. There are the things that the government doesn't do as well. We have been struggling with the issue of agricultural labor for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's deeply ingrained in our history and in our culture. The approach the Coalition of Immokalee Workers has taken with the Fair Food Program is a non-governmental solution to one of these persistent and complex policy problems. It is that comprehensiveness, the focus on developing a comprehensive solution that results in real, measurable, sustainable change that is so distinctive about the coalition. I completely agree with Mealy. This is not the case in most of the country. It is the case in the tomato fields and increasingly in strawberries and peppers on the East Coast, where these conditions have been eliminated. And they've done this through a comprehensive program that begins with a code of conduct, so a set of standards that is inspired by the workers themselves. I mentioned the tomato bucket earlier. That's not a problem someone from the outside would have ever identified. It certainly would not have been identified as the primary flashpoint for violence. So the code of conduct comes from the workers' own expertise, their own experience. It's then the workers, there's a comprehensive worker-to-worker education program so that every worker is aware of what the code of conduct is and what their rights are. It's a comprehensive monitoring system that includes, as John Esform says, the Fair Food Standards Council, which does formal audits, scheduled and unscheduled audits, but also the workers themselves are monitoring. There's a 24/7 hotline available in numerous languages because, remember, many of these workers, neither Spanish nor English is often their first language. They're able to report. They know what their rights are. They're able to report, and they are protected from any retribution. The Fair Food Standards Council conducts investigations of any violations that are reported, either found in their own audits or by the workers themselves, or sometimes by the growers these days. They do the investigations, and they do them very quickly. So unlike the traditional legal system, courts-oriented system, these violations are investigated in and resolved in often 2 to 3 days. A really long case is week or 1 week or two. If the growers don't come into compliance with a code of conduct very quickly, then they lose, as they're suspended from the program, and they lose access to a significant part of the tomato markets, and that's all the fair food growers. Those real-world market sanctions, combined with the education, the code of conduct, the education, the monitoring, et cetera, results in a distinctly, uniquely comprehensive system that, as I said, has eliminated the conditions that have allowed these abuses to occur and has nearly doubled farm worker labor.
Well, that's all the time we have. Susan Marquis, Dean of the Pardee Rand Graduate School, author of I Am Not a Tractor, How Florida Farm Workers Took on the Fast Food Giants and Won. Mili Trevino Saceda with the Women's Farm Workers Movement. John S. Forms, a grower with Sunripe Certified Brands and Pacific Tomato Growers. Do not forget what he said, attributing it to Martin Luther King, this being Martin Luther King Week. Some are guilty, all are responsible. Thank you all very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Today's To the Point podcast was produced by Andrea Brody and Devin Schwartz. Our engineers are Mike Newport and Joel Stein. I'm Warren Olney. To the Point is available on Apple Podcasts and other platforms and at kcrw.com/To the Point. Join us again and again.